The Tom Woods Show, episode 898.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, all you shavers out there, Harry's wants to send you a free trial set. Razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. Best shave you ever had, just pay for shipping. Check it out at harrys.com/woods. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Toby Baxendale is back on the show. Toby is an entrepreneur who also founded the Cobden Center, which you can visit at cobdencenter.org, center spelled in the British way, of course, with the T-R-E, which is a great libertarian website, by the way, for you to check out. Hardcore, sound, great, punchy. And he wanted to come back on to talk about Brexit, which is now actually underway. The actual process of withdrawing from the European Union is actually underway. The process is supposed to take 2 years. We're going to talk about that, I'm sure, in our conversation. And with it now underway, he wanted to clarify what exactly it means, because the impression that people have been given is that it means retrenchment by Britain, it means isolation, it means protectionism. And he is arguing this is a complete misreading of what's happening. And I thought that was a worthy subject of discussion. Toby, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Tom, for having me back.
I've spoken to a lot of people from the UK who are libertarians, and generally, as you might expect, they were in favor of Brexit. But I did get a minority view among some of them who seemed to feel that maybe the whole project of Brexit was being a bit oversold, that it was being promised as a great liberation, when in fact all it meant was that now we're going to be subject to the equally crummy or perhaps crummier UK bureaucrats, and it's not so clear that as a practical matter this is something to cheer. What's wrong with that way of thinking?
Well, that's a very interesting thought process, and I do have a lot of sympathy with it, of course, but I think what we must always bear in mind in this is that getting rid of one large layer of government, and particularly a sort of gigantic elephant tight, you know, bureaucratic, sluggish, you know, edifice, BMS that the European Union was, that's a good thing. And that should be thoroughly welcomed. And yes, it will mean we'll get our own bureaucrats back, doing the various things. But let's face it, you know, we had many centuries, if not millennia, of continuous history running under our own devices, with only 43 years running under the European Union, and I think we've got a better track record outside it. So yes, we are just going to be ruled by our own people and our own bureaucrats, our own elected politicians, but it's a damn sight better, let me tell you, than being run by virtually unaccountable people in distant lands.
Now, let me tell you the interpretation of Brexit that's been placed on it by a lot of people, a lot of Americans, maybe a lot of people in the UK, for all I know, that I know you want to do something to overturn. And that's the view that Brexit means a return to isolation. It means the adoption of protectionist measures. It means a revulsion against the free market itself. Now, that is a view that a lot of people have. Where's it going wrong? But there are people who believe that, though, in the UK.
No, there are. And Tom, that is, if you read the Metropolitan Elite Press, and if you listen to the regular media channels, then you know if you're a Brexiteer, you're a swivel-eyed lunatic, xenophobe, Little Englander. So that's a quick way to sum up what the view that you've just expressed there, and the reality is there were two strains of thought in the Brexit debate. There are those people who are Little Englanders and isolationists and xenophobic, and they're centred around the people like Nigel Farage, who's an extremely good publicist. And leader of, he was leader at the time of the UK Independence Party, he's seen cavorting as the first UK politician over with President-elect Donald Trump. But that is a very much a minority view of the Brexiteers. The official Leave campaign was run by people who had described themselves as largely, broadly speaking, conservative politicians, but of the libertarian bent in American language, or classical liberals in European language, or even Whigs from the old Whig Party that predates the Liberal Party here. And that was the official campaigning designation, was run by the people looking for very much an open Britain, and a Britain that is in fact not stuck in a protectionist trade body, which the European Union was. But worse than that, I mean, to a certain extent, the protectionist trade body of being able to at least free trade within your own borders of 28 countries, you know, is not a bad thing. It's still a protectionist bloc, and from a free market perspective, we must still resist it. But from a really, 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 really dangerous situation developed over the last decade and a half, where ever closer political union became the mantra of formerly what was called the European Economic Union. So people who thought they were getting involved in a free trade zone, albeit only in the 28 member states, it soon became a political project. And you see, the people who ran the official Leave campaign are all people who do not want anything whatsoever to do with that political, grandiose political project of creating, you know, a European empire that can, you know, hold its own against the Chinese and against the Americans and sort of power block politics. We have no interest in that. And the people who actually won the whole Brexit issue are out and out free traders, and they're looking for an open and engaging Britain. And remember, Britain has a great history in this, being, you know, at the forefront of the Industrial Revolution, leading free trade around the world, and, you know, particularly the likes of Richard Cobden and Bright, the Cobden Chevalier Act of 1860, giving unilateral free trade, setting the example to the world. And we, you know, we know what that did to boost the Industrial Revolution. So my point to your American audience, Tom, is we're often now, I'm seeing, being compared with Le Penites and Trumpites, who are out and out protectionists. They're exactly diametrically opposed to what you're going to see as a result of Brexit, you know, which will be a liberalisation of trade across the globe for this country. And we're in, I classify it, Tom, as an unfrozen moment, or I describe it as an unfrozen moment, when the tectonic plates of politics and economics, you know, are just, you've got a window to move them, and move them quite a big distance, and then they'll freeze up again for, you know, several decades. This is it. So it's actually a victory for the free trade, classical liberal stroke libertarian position, you know, and it's never going to be ideal for everybody. And, you know, purists who we know a number of will, you know, still have a moan that it's not, you know, true unilateral free trade and so on and so forth. And no doubt there'll be little deals done here and little deals done there. But it's a significant move in the right direction that should be welcomed.
All right. Let me ask you this, because I'd love to believe that what you're telling me is the case, and I have no reason not to believe it. But yet we hear so much to the contrary here. Free trade in the U.S. is actually not all that popular. If you look at opinion polls, really not. People don't really understand it. They think it's actually harming their standard of living. Mm. And what I wonder is, even if the official people, let's say, who were running the Leave campaign were libertarians and free traders, that doesn't mean that's why the average Joe voted to leave. Do you have any poll data that shows that the people who voted to leave were not voting for a little England, but they were voting for a free and open England with free trade?
Well, unfortunately, Tom, the message that then gets out to the media and what the media you know, campaign on, and I think what a lot of people then voted on were, you know, we don't like the immigrants' automatic use of the National Health Service. We don't like all the public services being put under significant stress because we got 3 million people from the European Union stressing out the public services. So yes, there was a lot of that, and a significant portion of those people those people were voting for those kind of reasons. I wouldn't say racist reasons. They're just pointing out that, you know, when they go to the doctor's surgery and they can't get seen, you know, then, and they see see a load of Poles and a load of Romanians and a load of Bulgarians in there. They're doing 2 + 2 = 5, and that's the kind of conclusions they come to. And yes, the bottom line is a lot of people did vote as you said, but a lot of people, you know, did vote as well. You know, remember that the official Leave campaign was always, we're going to be going for free trade agreements around the world, and they did vote for that as well. But it's never really raised as an issue, because it's not quite as newsworthy, you know, when you can run, you know, a horrible immigration story in the red top newspapers, which gets you headlines, rather than a kind of, you know, run a story about the law of comparative advantage, and how, you know, it's going to be, free trade is going to be good actually for all participants in the United Kingdom. So that's where it all got lost in the more public debates. But bottom line is, the official Leave campaign did run on that agenda, and, you know, it did get over the line, as we know, 52%.
Isn't it the case that in the European Union, they already favored free trade? So doesn't this seem like a real subtle point to expect the average voter to get? Well, we still want to maintain free trade, but we just want to make our own decisions about it. I mean, surely something else must have been driving Brexit.
Oh, yeah, no, something was, Tom. But I'll just go back to the first point of that, yeah? If you speak to someone, mainstream European, you know, politician, they all act lyrical that in the European common market area itself, you know, the 28 nations, you can move your goods wherever you like, be it, you know, mechanical goods, intellectual property, be it yourself, you can move around there totally freely. And that is correct. Yeah. And they will say, well, this is the ultimate free trade model. But of course it isn't. Yeah. Because you've got huge protectionist barriers wrapping round the whole of the 28, which is anti the poor primarily, because the interests that are protected are invariably inefficient agriculture. So you've got whole swathes of people you're discriminating against, farmers around the world, you know, in the poorer nations who cannot send their produce into the European Union. So you're forcing your citizens as well to pay higher prices. So yes, they say on the one hand they're free traders, but they're not. You know, they can't be. They're free traders for their own little club. Yeah, but that's it. It's kind of sod you for the rest of the world, which is not, you know, an open an engaging way to be. And this is the thing that's very, very frustrating, because they'll quite happily call the Little Englander Brexiteers xenophobic when they're ultimately xenophobic. It's a European elite club that works for itself. Yeah, but it works to itself to a certain extent, but as you know, ultimately it will impoverish its own people, because it's not letting them buy, you know, American beef, for example, from more efficient American farmers. It's not letting you buy grain from the Ukraine or from Paraguay or from Australia or from anywhere produce coming out of Africa without paying huge, great big tariffs. So that's where it's free trade to a point, yeah, is the European Union. And then, yes, going back to your, you know, question about what was driving Brexit. Now, what was driving Brexit? The real, you know, reasons why the 52 were so... so motivated, you know, it's one of the highest electoral turnouts we've ever had in living memory, was because the elite have disengaged. The global international elite have disengaged and left these people behind. You know, if you're a steel worker in Sunderland, yeah, and you see in the city of London a man earning £600,000 a year or £1 million a year, and he's working for a bank that's owned by the taxpayer, yeah, and he's been bailed out, the whole money and banking system, which we know has in effect been all bailed out and subsidized by the taxpayer, you may not be sophisticated to know why that's happened, but you know, as that steelworker who's been having his job threatened, yeah, you know you're being ripped off, yeah? You'll know you're being ripped off, and you know it's always the elites manage to line their own pockets and manage to survive. And that's why they voted, Tom. That's why there was a huge outturning. And it's in all the poorer areas, in the coal mining areas of Wales, the old steel places up in the north of England and in the Midlands. You know, they came out and they revolted against the elites, because the elites have seemed to have lined their pockets at the expense of the majority of the people. That is the real ultimate reason why people have voted Brexit. Yes, the free. I love to think that, you know, we had a massive free trade. People, of course I would. It was important, but it wasn't the be all and the end all was the disconnection between largely the southern, largely London based metropolitan elite and the rest of the nation. And that's it in a nutshell.
We'll continue this conversation after we thank our sponsor. Folks, I am here not just to educate, but also to improve your life in innumerable ways. And one ingredient in a happy life has to be a non-bloody face. In fact, now that I think about it, I can't think of any happy lives that involve bloody faces. Come on now, man. One of the things you want is a comfortable, close shave that makes you look great. That doesn't make you look like a caveman who found some kind of sharp thing on the ground and rubbed it against his face. So that's why I'm very happy to share with you my excellent experiences with Harry's Razors. I get close shaves, non-bloody shaves, and I am a happy man. And look, Harry's is making it easy on listeners of this show to get started, because they're going to send you a free trial set. That's a 13-smacker value. So get cracking today. Claim that free trial offer over at harrys.com/woods. That's a razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, and shave gel. harrys.com/woods, and grab it. All right, Toby, let's talk a little bit about free trade itself here, because free trade seems to me to be a hard thing to defend for this reason. When we think about public choice analysis, we think about, for example, why there would be quotas on oranges when that only benefits the orange growers. It doesn't benefit the public at large. But then you realize, well, the reason that they get the quotas is that they're a concentrated group and they enjoy the concentrated benefit that, so to speak, that comes from orange quotas. Whereas I, as a consumer of orange juice, am suffering only very slightly from a very slight increase in the price of oranges,
yeah.
And I'm very disorganized with all my fellow consumers of orange juice. We're not going to get together and fight that. Wouldn't be worth our time. So the concentrated benefit to the concentrated interest group tends to win out. It looks to me, though, like free trade is the mirror image of that, because free trade is a case where instead of the pain being spread out and the benefits are concentrated, the pain is concentrated and the benefits are spread out. So the average person is enjoying a tiny little benefit all the time, every time trade is expanded. His prices go slightly down, but slightly, and they probably don't know why their prices are going down. But what they do know is the lumber industry is suffering. The steel industry is suffering. They see the concentrated pain. And so, for example, in the U.S., we're reading news that the president wants to put tariffs on some forms of Canadian lumber. Now, the average person might think, well, I don't care anything about lumber, and maybe that helps some Americans. But when their house price goes up, they won't make the connection. The pain they feel, they won't make the connection. But they'll see the concentrated pain and therefore the concentrated benefit that these people get from protectionism. So see what I mean? It's a hard thing to sell, because we're selling them on benefits that are dispersed and nonspecific, and yet they can turn around and talk about, point to very specific pain points of industries that suffer from free trade. How do we overcome that?
Well, Tom, you've hit the nail on the head. It's very, very perceptive of you. But the only thing I think it's incumbent upon us people who know a little bit about economics to not kind of just, you know, give up at that problem, but to say, yes, you know, the lumber industry, presumably it's the Canadian lumber industry, has you know, a comparative advantage over the American lumber industry. Donald Trump am I right in saying he's put a tariff up against instantaneously against the Canadian lumber industry? Is that why you mentioned it?
Yes, that's what it looks like.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. Okay. Well, you know, it goes back to, in the doctor's surgery, the doctor can do the receptionist job very easily. He's an educated person, he or she. They could get rid of the receptionist. They have an absolute advantage over the receptionist, but they will treat less patients. Yeah. So who loses? The community loses. Now, I don't know, Tom, but maybe we just need to bring it back down to real local examples of where comparative advantage always works. Yeah, so you can understand it in your community. You can understand it in your daily life, because each and every single one of you, one of us in the whole of society, always operates to the law of comparative advantage. We do that in our families. We do that in our workplaces. So maybe a ground up approach, you know, will then we be able to say, well, you know, actually in the lumber industry, that particular example, if we start trading on our absolute advantages, we'll be like the doctor in taking the receptionist job. At the end of the day, we'll treat less people, and that is what will be the end result. Yeah, and we've got to be confident enough to keep on giving out this message and fighting these protectionist tariffs. Because sadly, all Canada's going to do at some point in time, if it gets a few more of these, it will erect a load of tariffs against the people of the USA, and then they will start feeling it. Yeah, and you know how that goes, these
right.
Pathetic spirals of trade wars and tariffs. So yes, you lose the argument in the moment, but I think we've got to get it really, really, really back to Billy Basics, so people can relate. People have got to be able to relate to it in their daily lives. That's how I think you can present the free trade argument better.
Now, my understanding is it's going to take another 2 full years before Brexit is fully carried out. Am I right about that?
Yes, well, it's curious. It's Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty. And yes, we've got 23 months left now. Now, officially, we can't negotiate with anybody. Yeah, anybody. We're still governed by our membership rules of the European Union. So even if Donald Trump, you know, knocked on our door tomorrow and said, hey guys, let's do a free trade agreement, we technically can't talk to you until after the March 2019, which means we'll be coming out of one set of rules, and then, you know, on day one we're then supposed to then start negotiating with the rest of the world. Now, I think people are going to be sensible and practical about this, and know that the UK has to actually start thinking about its post-March 2019 existence, and will hopefully be allowed to negotiate external agreements. But the European Union at the moment are playing quite hardball, because they're talking about money issues first, because being a member of the club, you obviously owe subscriptions. So there's a big argument about, well, you owe this, and the European Union is saying, quoting a kind of 50 million euro figure, 50 billion, sorry, I beg your pardon, figure, or it might even be 60 billion, and we think it might be about, 10 or 15 billion. And then there's, of course, all the share of the assets that we own in the whole European infrastructure. In the various European countries, which we are saying is worth, I don't even know if they put a figure on it, but it's a big number in many billions. So there's dancing around the handbags going on, deciding who owes what to whom. That's got to get done first, and then they'll start talking turkey with us about what type of specific disengagement agreements we will have. And hopefully at that point we can say, well, and we want to be given, you know, good grace to go and negotiate some free trade agreements, because they do take some time.
What is the reason behind this provision that you would need this 2-year delay?
Well, it is. The reason you would have thought is precisely so that you can line up your, your soft landing.
Right, and they won't let you do it.
No. It's you can't talk to anyone because you're still a member. You're still a member, therefore you're bound by the members' rules. And, you know, and when you become a member, you cede all your negotiating ability on external arrangements with other countries to the European Union. So it's one of those awkward ones. But I pray and I do genuinely pray that politicians will get out the way, and all this kind of ego will get out the way, and it'll be sensible. Because bottom line is, Tom, just like you want Canada and you want Mexico to be good, healthy neighbours, you know, we want the European Union to be a good, healthy neighbour to us. As I hope they want us to be a good, healthy neighbor to them. So hopefully reason will prevail. But, you know, politicians, they tend to disappoint, don't they?
Do you have any final thoughts on this issue that we haven't covered before we wrap up for today?
Well, I would just like to say, you know, to your American audience, we did a truly fantastic, miraculous thing on the 23rd of June of last year, 2016, and it is a victory for open and free trade. And when I see you in a very difficult political situation with a protectionist president, that you derive a lot of courage, you should derive a lot of courage from us, that we can build a better world based on the principles of being open and free and trading with each other. And I just hope there's enough Americans in there who will really, really fight the fight.
Well, of course, I hope so, too. And I'm glad you wrote to me. But next time we have to meet on a platform other than Twitter, though, because the direct messages on Twitter, I never think to do. I'm not as savvy on Twitter as I ought to be. But anyway, I'm glad you wrote to me, because it turns out that I had been laboring under, at least a partial misconception about the nature of Brexit and what it was all about. And I'm glad to hear that the Toby Baxendale version of Brexit is more likely the correct one than the Nigel Farage one. And I mean, I kind of like Nigel Farage just because I like the way he presents himself. I don't agree with him all the time, but he's a tough cookie and he's charismatic and I go for those things, and he has the right enemies. And sometimes I draw some conclusions from that, but all those things can be said about you times 1,000. So I'm glad that it's the Baxendalians who are carrying the day. Best of luck just continuing to spread the word there. We certainly appreciate it.
Well, that's very kind of you, Tom. Thank you very much. And, I really, really hope for you guys. I hope and I pray that we can get an open and free trade agreement with you in America. That would be glorious.
Yeah, there's absolutely no reason for that not to happen. So,
yeah.
But of course, you could say that about a lot of things, and they find a reason. But anyway, thanks a lot, Toby. Appreciate it.
Yeah, cheers, and Tom. Thank you very much. God bless.
All right, that's going to do it for us for today. Tomorrow, if all goes well, we are going to talk about the Armenian Genocide, which is a topic I've had many requests for, and your wish is my command. So expect that on episode 899, and I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.